63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Stay tuned for the food show.
Need some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
On the show today, we talk with Katrina Blair, founder of the Turtle Lake Refuge in Colorado and author of the book Wild Wisdom of Weeds, 13 Essential Plants for Human Survival.
We will be talking with Proper, a North Portland community enhancement organization, about their free Thanksgiving feast where they plan to feed about 1,000 people.
We'll also hear from Michael Mazurek, a plant breeder and professor at Cornell University, about plant breeding and a new variety of pepper he's created called Habanada.
But first, we'll listen to an interview with Marisha Auerbach. Marisha is a permaculture teacher and consultant based here in Portland. She graduated from Evergreen State College in 98, studying ethnobotany, ecological agriculture, and sustainability. Since, she's been teaching permaculture in the Pacific Northwest for over a decade, as well as working with a number of nonprofits and developing permaculture-based businesses. Last week, Marisha came into the studio and we talked about permaculture and her upcoming courses taking place in the Pacific Northwest as well as Belize. We'll go to the interview now, where we began by talking about the concept of permaculture. Marisha, tell us a little bit about what permaculture is and why it's important.
Okay, well, permaculture is most easily thought of as a combination of the words permanent and culture. And it's a design system for human life on this planet, where we look at the unique characteristics of where we live and how we can design, using those characteristics, how we can design sustainable human settlements where we're responsive to our regional climate and the terrain on which we live and what our weather patterns are. And all of these things help us design homes that keep us warm in the winter and minimize our energy uses and provide food for our community year-round. Permaculture design is important because currently we live in a global economy where a lot of the costs of our goods and services are hidden. And through that, we're unable to see that people aren't getting a living wage for some of the things we consume, or the amount of pollution that's going into the atmosphere, or the ways that we're treating the landscape, maybe causing desertification or loss of habitat. So with permaculture design, by relocalizing our lives, we're able to take into consideration what's needed to design sustainably where we live and be able to increase habitat and increase the conditions for workers so that people are able to get a living wage and have a life that nourishes them.
And you teach some permaculture design courses here in Portland. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I teach at Portland Community College in the landscape department in the summer. And this is a really great addition to the landscape department at Portland Community College, as the landscapers that are going through the program are learning how to decrease their use of pesticides and chemicals and be able to minimize work in landscapes by designing based on nature. I also teach at Pacific University in Forest Grove, and during the year, fall, winter, and spring semester, I teach an online course at Oregon State University. Our course through Oregon State University is really diverse since it's online. It's very academic and focused on site analysis, informing one's final conceptual design. And we have students primarily in Cascadia, but we also have students all over the world. Currently, I have a student who's in Slovenia and one who's in Puerto Rico, and we just got someone who signed up from Laos. So it's pretty interesting to look at the diversity of expression and how people can apply permaculture principles and mimic nature and develop sustainable lifestyles based on the unique characteristics of where they live. Well, I also teach a monthly workshop series at People's Food Co-op for anyone who wants to drop in. It starts in February and it ends in November. It's a monthly workshop on what to do now in the garden. So each month I highlight what's going on in the garden, what should people be doing to make sure that they can maximize food production where they live, and a different theme that's relevant for that month, whether it's making soup in November or water catchment in July when our rains stop, or attracting beneficial insects in May when we're at the peak of flowering in the summer. So this monthly workshop series is offered as a series. Someone could sign up for the whole series, which runs February through November, or someone could sign up for just one class at a time. And it's at People's Food Co-op. We also do a once-a-month open house in my garden so that people can see what it's like to have year-round food production. I've been growing most of my own food year-round for about the last over 10 years now. And I find that it's really great to be growing food locally in my backyard. It doesn't take that much work. I probably spend as much time growing my own food as if I were maintaining a lawn. And it certainly doesn't emit as much pollution. We're growing all sorts of different things. I actually was successful this year in growing sweet potatoes on the roof. We put in a 1,000 square foot green roof to be able to maximize microclimate so we could grow some warmer climate things. And my diet changes with the seasons. But most of all, when you grow local food, you know what the ecological footprint is to the food that you're eating. You know that you're not causing desertification by supporting farmers to grow a monocultural crop in the desert. You know that you're not contributing to the to some of the diseases that are affecting the bees, and that instead you're really providing habitat and creating regenerative ecosystems where you live.
Do you feel like this idea is catching on a lot around the states and around the world?
I think in Portland, we're at the forefront of it all. I think we have probably more year-round farmers markets than most other places in a climate like ours. I think there's a lot of people here in Portland that value local food. It's not as easy for everyone to grow their own food. In permaculture, we actually highlight if you can only grow a few things, you know, what's the most important things to grow? It's better to grow things that are highly nutritious, that have a short shelf life, rather than something that doesn't cost very much and can be bought from a local farmer. Around the world, I think people are waking up in other areas, and that food production and sustainable lifestyles are increasing, especially as people notice how much more expensive goods and services have gotten as the price of oil goes up. But, you know, nowhere's really as progressive as Portland that I've visited, and I am fortunate to go to many different places. Last year, I was actually fortunate to represent for Portland at the International Permaculture Convergence. We have an international gathering every 2 years, and last year it was in Cuba. And I was asked to be one of the keynotes at the event to talk about urban permaculture in Portland. And I was pretty amazed that in a community of people where we had 48 different countries represented and about 500 people from all over the world, that just about everyone was pretty amazed at how progressive we are in Portland and how many codes and sustainability endeavors are now legal in our city.
What do you think it is that has led Portland to be a leader in the permaculture movement?
That's a good question. I think we're fortunate as far as food production to have a really mild growing season. I think that we're also fortunate to have forests in our vicinity that are still there to inspire people to collaborate with nature. We have a lot of people that live here in Portland that really like the outdoors and like outdoor adventures. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I don't remember there being many woods that I could go and be inspired in. So when I graduated from high school, I quickly wanted to come out west where we did have really beautiful intact ecosystems. And I draw on that inspiration whenever I do designs.
You're teaching a course coming up in Belize. So how is it different than what you would be teaching here in Portland?
Well, the course in Belize is the 72-hour permaculture design course. So it's generally offered in a 2-week retreat format. And the curriculum that we offer is the same that's offered in every permaculture course all over the world. At the end of these courses, students present a design project where they incorporate what they've learned in the course. And after they complete the design project and all of the curriculum of the course, they're given an internationally recognized certificate, which says they completed the permaculture design course curriculum. How the course in Belize is different is that it's in a really remote location, which is super authentic as far as living in a permaculture design. The course is at Maya Mountain Research Farm, which is in San Pedro, Colombia, Belize. And so you actually have to go all the way into the far south of Belize, into San Pedro, into Punta Gorda. And from Punta Gorda, you take a bus to the nearest Mayan village. And from there, you have to go up the river in a dugout canoe, or you go on a walk through the woods, and then you have to ford the river to get to the site. So the site isn't accessible by car. All of the food is grown in that river valley. They actually hire a local Mayan family to provide the food that they don't grow on site during the course to help stimulate their economy there. And the site is entirely off the grid. All of the structures have been made with materials from the site or from the river valley there. And it's just really incredible to be completely immersed in the local conditions down there in the far south of Belize. Belize is a really interesting place too, because it's due to the terrain in Belize. From the east, it's connected to the Pacific Ocean or to the Atlantic Ocean, and to the west there's the Maya Mountains. So there's this bottleneck that happens ecologically in that space, and they actually have more wild cats than anywhere else in the world, and they have more diversity of species, of plant species as well, of anywhere else in the world. And they have all these tremendously wonderful tropical crops that we like to eat up here. On site, they're growing cardamom and pineapple and coffee. And one of their key crops is the Mayan Criolla cacao. So it's a really great place to be. And I feel really honored to be able to learn from the space where cacao came from. And as a chocolate lover, it's pretty awesome. They also grow vanilla there, black pepper. And then there's, you know, your usual tropical crops like coconut, breadfruit, banana, mango, citrus. It's just really delightful. And the site is just a little bit down the river from the source, which is the space where the river comes out of the hillside. And it's just this beautiful waterfall that we visit during the class.
How did you end up connecting with the Mayans in Belize and having this series happened there?
I went down to Belize about 12 years ago and just on a trip, and ended up visiting this site. And since then, I've really developed my permaculture teaching, and I teach all over now. I've taught in other countries as well and all over the United States. So when they needed another teacher for the course, they asked me to join them. And the course is, we had about 7 Mayans, 1 Garifuna from Belize City, and then we have people from all over the world also join. So it's really cool, the cross-cultural collaboration that happens with this course.
So let's go back to Portland and let's talk about what your garden looks like right now.
Well, right now we're just experiencing the first frost this week, and so it's cold out there. Right now, some of the things that I can harvest through the year that I have growing right now is leeks and kale. I've got a lot of potatoes in the ground. I also grew a bunch of sweet potatoes, but those are on the roof. Inside the house, I have some garlic and squash, so that's to support the winter diet. There's lots of parsnips in the ground. I'm kind of known for growing parsnips. They're one of my favorite crops. I also have beets and carrots. I think the chard survived the frost okay once it thaws. So we have lots of chard. We also have some lettuces, which may or may not have survived. My favorite winter greens for salads that do well once it gets cold is mache, chervil, and chickweed. So I'll have those. I also have some tubers from the Andes that are growing that I'll be eating in the winter. One's called Mashua. It's the perennial nasturtium. And that plant actually starts blooming when it gets cold. And the colder it gets or the rainier it gets and the nastier out, the brighter the beautiful orange tubular blooms become, which is really great for the hummingbirds. They were outside this morning looking for the pineapple sage, which had to come inside because of the frost. And I was just happy to know that I had other things out there for them to eat, since in this cold weather, it gets really hard for the wildlife to find food. So Mashua also provides a spicy tuber that you can eat, similar to potato. So I have that in the garden. I also have one called oca, which is a perennial tuber from the Andes. The oca tubers are either pink or yellow, so they're really beautiful. Those become ready in around January. And in January, my Jerusalem artichokes also become ready. I have both white and pink Jerusalem artichokes in the ground for the winter. I also am growing a perennial tuber called yacón, which is related to the dahlia. And that actually needs to come inside now that it frosted. I need to harvest those tubers and bring them inside to overwinter. I have walking onions, other top-setting onions, Welsh onions. There's all sorts of stuff out there. And it's really amazing. A lot of people think that there isn't that much diversity that we can eat coming from our local area in the winter. But there's really so much that we can grow and have throughout the year.
It might be a little bit late since we already had a frost, but what methods do you use to protect your plants during the winter?
Well, I use a lot of mulch to cover things, and it's not too late to put mulch on top of your carrots or your beets or your potatoes. The mulch helps protect them from frost and also from the rain. Over time, they can start to disintegrate at the top and get really, you know, slimy and just start to decompose. So when you have mulch on top of them, they don't do that. I actually don't have a greenhouse outside. If I were expecting it to be cold, I would probably throw a sheet on top of some things to just keep it a little warmer. But preparing for the frost was mostly all about bringing in the warm season crops and putting some mulch or a blanket, you know, on the cold season crops. So we brought in our pepper plants, and I've made fermented hot pepper sauce. I've also made a lot of salsa for the winter, tomato sauce. I do a lot of canning and a lot of drying so that the warm season crops are able to last throughout the year as well.
Is there anything that we can do in the garden now to prepare for next year?
Well, mulching the garden is really important for the winter. It's really amazing to think about the weight of a raindrop on the soil. You know, rain can cause compaction on our soil, and when your soil becomes compacted, there's not a lot of airflow and water flow that happens through your soil. So just by adding mulch on top of your soil in the rainy season really helps with its receptivity for air and water come the growing season when it warms up. That's probably about the most important thing we can do. And then for planning for the winter, you know, it's really important to provide habitat for critters and for birds and bees and hummingbirds and all those things that are out there. You know, even my neighbors have a party every year where they make suet and bird feeders for the birds throughout the winter. I think that sounds like a good party.
Is there any particular type of mulch that you like to use?
I like to use wood chip mulch because I can get it easily from my friend who's an arborist. He's really great because he high grades his wood chips and gives me the ones that I like best, which are the ones that can be inoculated with mushrooms. And once it's not so cold out, I'll probably have another flush of some of the mushrooms that I've got growing in my garden. The King Stropharia has naturalized really nicely in my garden, and that's always a delightful addition to meals. And I use the wood chips mostly in with my berry bushes and my fruit trees. And in my zone one area, which would be the area closest to my door where I grow my annual vegetables, I like to use leaves. So that's something that anyone can do right now is rake up the leaves in your neighborhood. Go offer to rake your neighbor's leaves and put them on top of your garden to prevent erosion and compaction. Some of the best leaves to use are oak and maple. So if you're out there looking for leaves, those are the best ones to source.
All right. So where can we find the information if anyone is interested in taking your courses?
Well, the information can be found on permaculturerising.com. That's my website. And I'd also like to mention that there's one other permaculture design course that I'm teaching coming up. It's similar to the course in Belize. It has the same curriculum. It's also a two-week intensive. But this one's a lot closer and a lot it doesn't have a spendy plane ticket associated with it. It's in Eugene, Oregon, outside of Eugene, at the Lost Valley Education Center. And that course is going from December 4th until December 17th. So it's a permaculture design course. And I'm teaching that course with Jude Hobbs and Rick Valley. And we'll be looking at the basics of permaculture and how to use this design system to design our lives, our gardens, our businesses, and how it applies in every aspect of our lives.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was an interview with Marisha Auerbach, permaculture teacher and consultant who is teaching upcoming courses on permaculture. For more information, you can visit permaculturerising.com or link to the website on The Food Show.
Katrina Blair was recently in Portland teaching a class on edible weeds at Reed College. She recently wrote the book Wild Wisdom of Weeds, 13 Essential Plants for Human Survival, where she talks about the importance of certain plants that are often labeled invasive or are overlooked. My interview with Katrina was recorded here at KBOO.
My name's Katrina Blair, and I am the founder of Turtle Lake Refuge in Durango, Colorado, as well as the author of The Wild Wisdom of Weeds, 13 Essential Plants for Human Survival.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Turtle Lake Refuge?
Sure. So Turtle Lake Refuge is located in Durango, Colorado, and our mission is to celebrate the connection between personal health and wild lands. And although we started about 16 years ago on one piece of land that was right near a lake called Turtle Lake that has lots of turtles living in it, and we're with the help of a neighbor who actually purchased the land and put it into a conservation easement, that first little project actually was successful. And we realized our bigger mission is honoring and protecting wild lands everywhere in the world. And part of the way we do that is through educating how we can utilize a lot of the wild plants, especially the weeds, for food and health.
So do you offer like classes, seminars?
Yes. So Turtle Lake Refuge does offer lots of classes, and we have a wild food cafe. If you ever come through Durango, we serve a lunch, a wild food lunch twice a week. And we grow lots of food both in town in our cafe as well as out at the farm. And we have a farmer's market booth and a wild food CSA, and do a lot of education with both the public schools and the community.
You talk about it in the book. How did you come to become an ally of wild plants?
I think I was possessed by plants when I was 11. Had this real epiphany moment where I got filled up with energy sitting amongst all these plants, and they said, "You're home, and you're going to live your life with us." And then after that, I decided right after high school to camp out for a summer and eat all wild foods if possible, and I brought a bunch of books with me, and I brought a little bit of cereal, so some buckwheat, flax, and sunflower seeds that I would soak. But the rest of the time, I ate all wild. I didn't bring any other food up there and learned so much. And then I just kept going. It's almost like I learned from the inside out just by ingesting the plants. I started going deeper and deeper, and I'm still going. The journey's not over.
Right. You had a guide with, like, you know, books and whatnot, but then you actually got to know the plants via just interacting with them.
Yes. They're the best teachers for sure.
In this book, you choose 13 plants in particular. How did you go about choosing those 13 specific plants?
I actually feel like they chose me because I've traveled extensively around the world just from my parents taking us, and I went to high school in New Zealand. And anyway, everywhere I would go, I would notice these same plants were following me. I thought they were following me. And then as I started doing more research, I realized, oh, these plants actually grow on every continent where humans have permanent settlements. And I thought it was such an interesting contrast where these specific plants are often called invaders or invasives or noxious, or, and actually they are home everywhere on planet Earth.
So what are some of the common features that sort of bind these plants together?
So these 13 that were chosen for this book are all edible, and they're all medicinal. They're actually foods first and then medicines also, and incredibly accessible to most humans living in urban or rural places around the world, and often in abundance. Like, they just grow in sidewalk cracks and in garden, you know, walkways, and any open barren ground, basically, these plants will grow. And so those are a few characteristics.
And then you kind of mentioned this, that it happened that these plants were following you, but why focus on these common, kind of globally common plants versus focusing on plants from a specific region?
Well, the fun thing is that they're the same. These common global plants are the most abundant and easy to find in the local region too. So no matter what region you'll go to, all the local herbalists know these plants and utilize these plants commonly because they're so easily accessible and so useful in their food and medicine.
It's interesting. It's like music or, you know, language, how these plants are something that can kind of tie people together in many different places where people don't speak the same languages.
That is so exciting. I was at a restaurant the other day, a few weeks ago, in New York City. It was an Italian restaurant, and the Italian owner of the restaurant happened to see my book that was laying on the floor, and he opened it up, and he's like, oh, my grandmother in Italy made tortellinis out of mallow. Yeah. It is. It's like a common language that unites all peoples.
Now, you know, you talked about this, that these plants are considered invasive or unwanted, and you do use the word weed in the title, but I think you sort of take umbrage with considering them as weeds. What could you think of a name that could be used that could honor these plants?
I was thinking about that. Maybe you can help me, but I was thinking weeds could be wonderful, edible, and then we need another E and a D, like what weed stands for.
Excellent.
Wonderful, edible, excellent.
Dinner.
Yeah. Perfect. <Yeah. laughs> That's what it is.
It's a little bit specific. I'm sure you could also have them at other times of the day, but...
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Dining. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I just want you to maybe elaborate on that, the idea of these as invasive, but then also the fact that they are sort of naturalized. I mean, is it the fact that they show up in places where the environment's been disturbed? Like, what is it about them that gives them this bad name? I mean, I know the one for me, and I'll get to it in a second, but thistle, I mean, it hurts when you touch it. Like, so for me, it's a plant I avoid, but I'm wondering if you could talk more about the invasiveness.
Great, good questions. The 13 plants, I actually call them permaculture plants, but they're also pioneer plants or succession plants. And what it means is they can grow where nothing else can grow, or they can grow when the native environment has been disturbed, yes, like through human development, which we do quite a bit of. So these plants actually follow our footsteps as humankind. All of our disturbances creates the niche for these plants to thrive. And they go in and plant their seed when the native plants can't grow there anymore because it's been altered. So these little wild weeds can drop their seeds in, and then they develop these deep tap roots that break up the compaction of the soil and start aerating things and get the earthworms and the microorganisms active again. And then they pull up minerals and Then when their leaves compost each year, they rebuild topsoil and actually refertilize the ground in order that other species could then take hold and then keep growing. And that's how nature works until eventually an area, if it's been undisturbed long enough, it gets to a climax community, a plant community. And that's what we consider native. It's just been there a long time, but nature's always changing. And we change it very quickly as humans.
Mm-hmm. These are the helpers. They're the workers.
This is nature's first course of action mm-hmm. to help with disturbed land.
So I want to come back now to a specific plant. And I mentioned thistle earlier. To me, it's just the one that you have to have your gloves on when you're weeding the garden. But tell us about what specifically makes thistle, you know, why you include it in the book.
Don't be afraid of the prickle of the thistle. Drink down the juice. It'll make you want to whistle. So thistle is actually one of the most magical plants because it's really alkaline. And if you pick it from the back spine, you don't get pricked. There's no spines on the back or use gloves. But we sell out every Saturday at the farmer's market in Durango by selling both thistle lemonade and a thistle root chai tea. And thistle's amazing because not only does it regenerate liver cells in the body, but it alkalinizes the internal chemistry of the body, which creates a high. So when you smoke marijuana, you get an alkaloid experience. You get high for a little bit, but you come down. But when you drink thistle juice, you get high and you never come down. Mm-hmm. And it just really creates optimal health. But the thistle is an amazing plant, and you can eat every single part of it. The root is like a potato, and the stalk is like celery, and the greens can be juiced like into lemonade. The flowers make a delicious chewing gum, and the seeds make an amazing seed milk.
So it sounds like juicing it is one way. I mean, how do you process it to get it to the point of hurting you to being super beneficial?
So I'll carefully pick about 10 leaves, and I'll put them in the blender, and then I'll fill the blender up with water, add an apple and a lemon, and then blend it up and strain out all the prickles, and you've got this amazing green juice that's not bitter. It's actually really delicious.
Yeah, I'll have to try that. I've never thought of that. I've never thought of thistle as something that I would use in anything.
And then once you drink it, you start to feel so good, and you actually start to fall in love with the plant because it's starting to work from you from the inside out. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, now I'm part thistle. And you're getting that intelligence of that resiliency that is in the thistle. You start to actually embody it, and it helps you remember how to thrive even in this changing climate.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other plants that people would be surprised made the list?
Yeah, well, maybe lots of them. Let's say mallow. Mallow is an amazing plant that's commonly found in gardens. There's a lot of different varieties of mallow, but they're all edible. And they make, like, if you pull out your mallow plant because you want to plant your tomatoes or something, you can pull out the entire thing, roots and all, and then just wash it, chop it up, and put it in water. And within about an hour or two, the water has turned into white, like egg white consistency, sort of this gelatinous. And that is really good for the skin. Like, it hydrates the skin. It's really good to drink, and it pulls out congestion and is a really great base for some recipes in the book for both food and desserts, but also shampoo and lotion.
Now, I want to talk about that deep taproot. Now, I was wondering if there are any health risks when you're harvesting. And I'm thinking of, like, locations where maybe something was toxic originally. I feel like these plants, they're not only do they help in the succession, but they also help clean a space. So should people be on the lookout where they're harvesting these wild plants?
Yeah, so that is an important piece. We have to be really observant and tune in with all of our senses when we're harvesting. So, you know, if you have the option of going to more pristine environments, do. If you know, like, oh, this feels really good, go for that. But there's times when I'm, let's say, in New York City or San Francisco, and I'm in the middle of the city streets, and there's a dandelion growing up in the crack of the sidewalk. I realize, like, I tune in, and I realize that still that dandelion is beneficial for me, because, in fact, probably more nutritious than anything I could buy at the store, because I'm in that same environment. Like, I'm surrounded by all the pollution of the cars, and I'm breathing it and exposing myself to it. And the dandelion has already learned how to thrive in it. So not only does it help teach me how to thrive, but then it also detoxes my body of any pollutants that I might be taking in and storing in my body and helping me get rid of them. So there's that piece. But then, yes, if let's say an area has been sprayed with herbicides, you know, the plant might look sick or it might have a funny smell. Yeah, don't go there. Avoid like obvious toxic locations.
So I'm sure you want to encourage people to have their own relationships with these plants, but I'm curious, what do you want people to, anything else you want them to take from the book?
I would say one of the big messages of the book is conveying how we can develop a deep sense of trusting and more confidence and freedom for being able to manage in this changing world of fast-paced technology and fast-paced change, that our food and medicine is going to be around us, and it can let us relax into a deeper contentment. And also simple living. I mean, that's a big part. The more we're content and trust and live simply, the more we're going to take care of the earth also.
Katrina, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was Katrina Blair, author of Wild Wisdom of Weeds, 13 Essential Plants for Human Survival. For more information about Katrina, the Turtle Lake Refuge, and her book, you can visit The Food Show page on the KBOO website. I recently attended an event hosted by the Culinary Breeding Network, where farmers, plant breeders, and chefs were gathered to taste a number of varieties of different vegetables. There were a lot of conversations, and ultimately everyone who participated came away more aware of what the other folks in food were doing. While I was there, I was able to chat with Michael Mazurek, a plant breeder and professor at Cornell University, about his work. The interview was recorded in a remote stairwell at Chris King Precision Components in Portland, Oregon.
I'm Michael Mazurek. I'm an assistant professor and a vegetable breeder at Cornell University. My job there is to make new vegetable varieties that are delicious, stand up to disease without pesticide, and are productive in our short, turbulent northern growing conditions.
So I want to start with your schedule. As a plant breeder and assistant professor, what do you do on a daily basis?
It's different every day, and I really love that. I found out that's what I kind of need to have in a job for myself. So in the spring, we're planting. In the summer, the crop is growing. We're anticipating what's going to happen. The fall is a mad rush to the harvest before the frost. We analyze a lot of what we pulled out of the field. And then come January, it's full-time teaching. So I have a lot of undergrads I get to teach and a lot of graduate students. They're always a big part of what we do in the research and education side.
That's nice that there's a seasonality to your work.
I love the seasonality. If you're going to be in the northern U.S., you have to embrace seasonality.
Mm-hmm. It's just like the growing season then for the farmers who are using the plants that you're breeding.
Exactly.
Plant breeding is a long-term activity. How do you take into account the amount of time it takes for a variety to go from experimentation to market?
Yeah, so that time can really be quite a while. And usually a lot of that time is when we're really refining something and making sure there's enough seed for when people want to actually grow it on a commercial scale. So once we have the idea, to be able to find the plant in a population is a couple generations. But then to get it so it's true breeding, really uniform, is another 5 or 6 generations. And then when it comes time to say a company wants to offer the seed, it's like a cucumber variety, you go from me having a little coin envelope full of seed from one plant to needing to have barrels and barrels or maybe a small tractor trailer load of seed. So that takes several generations just to multiply the seed from there.
Is there ever a push-pull from like the companies and the plant breeder, like they're ready for the variety even though you don't think it's ready to be on the market?
Well, there's always stuff you wish would happen faster. One thing was really with the growers, they'd always like a solution next season. That's where we do a lot of our hybrids, is where we know we have a solution we can get the next season. But the beautiful thing we do in academia is we can also take things to an open pollinated variety. And so we do hybrids and OPs from the same cross.
So let's talk about hybrids and open pollinated. I mean, it seems like both of them have their place, but I know there is sort of this really big push for open pollinated. Mm-hmm. Could you just tell us the difference and then tell us, you know, kind of where you stand on the spectrum?
So I guess I'll start with, I'm pretty practical about, we'll come up with a variety that best suits what a grower needs, what the marketplace needs. The great things about hybrids is that you can stitch together a bunch of great characteristics in one winter, and then the growers can have seed of it the next summer. And we often do that as we're trying to find what's the best fit for a grower. We can really fine tune different characteristics, get a lot of uniformity, and often we can get a big yield bump. The issues with hybrids is there's also some just magical combinations in a hybrid that if you lose the source of the hybrid seed, then you are at the beginning of a breeding process instead of having another year of really good production.
So then the idea is, at least for the home grower, you know, open pollinated, they can actually collect the seed themselves, but it's going to take somebody with a scientific background to be able to do the hybrid developing.
The hybrids seem really foreign to a lot of people, but one of the things to realize is everybody here is a hybrid, you know, so it's just a mom and dad and their child is a hybrid. So there's a lot of hybrids that people can make at home. Some people near us call them farmer hybrids, where you just find two varieties you really like, cross it together, and you might find that you have something you really adore. You just have to every season do more crosses if you want more of the hybrid.
Mm-hmm. Whereas for the open pollinated, you're just going within the same variety year after year.
Yeah, and with the OP, it's really managing a population. And one of the main things with an open pollinated variety for on-farm variety improvement is it is kind of fits into the workflow often a little bit better, is you don't need to set aside time to do specific pollinations to combine certain traits. You can just be selecting the best. The tricky part is you have to remember not to send the best to market. The best is what you have to withhold seed from for next year.
So I want to talk about creating varieties and the traits that are in certain varieties. How important is flavor in particular compared to the other qualities like disease resistant or yield?
Yeah. Flavor is incredibly important if you have the market that appreciates it. There's a lot of our produce where everything is driven on price. And so if you want something that's really cheap, looks beautiful, and is really uniform, if that's what the market wants, that's what it's going to get. The big exciting part of my job has been some of the renaissance in flavor, and that just opens up whole new worlds. And that's for a lot of heirlooms. Heirlooms were developed at a time when people really valued flavor, when they were growing and saving seed for themselves, growing for their own kitchens. And so now we're starting to rethink and come back to some of those ideas.
So is there like, I can kind of see there could be like a top down for you. If you enjoyed certain flavors, then that you would be able to kind of infuse those into your plants. But at the same time, you're more accountable to market demands.
Yeah, and there's a lot in produce that is really looking at the retailer and how you're going to have a crop that really fits kind of some conventional display and shipping procedures. And so there's a lot that is done to fit that, and we have a fantastically productive agricultural system that does that, but so we're, for people who want something different, something more, there's oh so much more.
Mm-hmm. Like selecting for different traits, it's a very nuanced process, and there's a lot to choose for, and there's a lot of input that you have when mm-hmm. you're kind of creating it. We're at an event tonight where there's going to be a lot of people, chefs, farmers, and plant breeders coming together. Is it important to have these conversations on your end to be able to know who's going to be eating essentially the results of your plant breeding?
Certainly. And the more perspectives you can bring, the more of a broad approach you can have in the field. We'll go through the field and we'll be looking at thousands of different iterations on basically the same population and deciding what do you want to pick? And the more you know about all the different perspectives, not only can you think about things that are going to work for those different palettes and preferences, but you can also, your mind can be open to different aspects of the plant you didn't recognize before. Often as we have lots of international visitors, they give us completely new perspectives on crops we thought we knew really well.
It also seems like the more perspectives you get, the more sort of democratized the food system becomes. I mean, you're getting everybody's sort of, not necessarily getting what they want, but you're getting an idea of how to create plants for an equal food system.
Yeah, and it reminds me of one of the quotes from Liberty Hyde Bailey, a really famous plant breeder, and one of his quotes talked about, given all the different people in the world, why shouldn't they each be able to have the one plant they enjoy, or something along those lines.
So let's talk about a plant in particular. You were telling me earlier that you have a pepper variety that is soon going to be available on the market, which is exciting. I'm sure when you get to that point, could you tell us a little bit about that plant?
Yeah, so that is our pepper. One of the great things about when you develop a plant variety is you get to name it. And so I'm fond of my Spanglais, and so when we made our habanero without any heat, we named it the Habanada for the habanero with no heat. And so that was really fun for me because that was my first venture into plant breeding. It's when I moved from working in the lab and really studying the genes of peppers to actually saying, well, how can we actually create a new plant using what we've learned? And so that was something I developed during my PhD, and so it's almost a decade old. And I loved it. A lot of people that tried it loved it, but it never really found the partner that was going to introduce it to the marketplace. And then this year it looks like everything's in place and we should start to be able to see it come out for the first time next summer.
Can you tell us where we're going to be able to find it?
Yes, so it will be in a limited supply from Fruition Seeds, part of a great group of seed companies we have in the Northeast now that are all kind of partnering together to really get growers all the different seeds they need, and they're a fun, brand new partner in the mix.
And I imagine a kind of an exciting new variety that's got limited seeds. Probably going to go quick this first year.
It will, but you know, certainly look to see if you can get some. You know, it's a delicious pepper. It has you want to eat it when it's orange and ripe, and it has just a hint of spice, but a really floral character. And one thing we think that separates it from a lot of the other peppers in that similar mild habanero class is this one. You'll never get a surprise with one being a little hotter than you expected, and it has a delightful lingering sweetness. And so hopefully they'll be available in some of the markets on both coasts next summer.
Great. Well, yeah, I'm going to definitely keep my eyes out for them. So it'll be a nice addition to the garden. Great. Michael, thank you so much for talking with me.
No, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. For more information about Michael Mazurek and the Habanada pepper, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website.
And now we'll bring you a quick community announcement. The documentary Occupy the Farm, which tells the story of a community's fight to save public land for urban farming, is playing this week in Portland. The film documents what happens when 200 farmers march to the gates of the last farmland in California's urban East Bay, carrying tents, tools, and 15,000 seedlings. Occupy the Farm plays Wednesday and Thursday at the Regal Lloyd Cinema Center 10.
Thanksgiving is about a week away, and you're probably planning your meal, maybe for yourself, your friends, your family. Well, Proper, a North Portland Enhancement Organization, is also planning a meal for about 1,000 people. We have Robin Gordon, the director of Proper, and Pastor Antoine Tolbert, the designer for Proper, in the studio with us to talk about the Proper Thanksgiving Feast. Robin and Antoine, welcome to The Food Show.
Well, hello, and thank you for having us.
Hey, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the beginnings. How long have you been holding the Thanksgiving feast?
This is our 14th year doing this, and it's incredible every single time. I mean, one of the things, I know that this is a food show, and it's so interesting that our food is so great that I've eaten here for Thanksgiving the last 8 years that we've had it, and I've never missed Thanksgiving anywhere else. It's just incredible. The food is, everything is prepared fresh the night before and the day of and overnight by Chef James Bradley of Poshines, as well as Miss Tamara Tobert, one of the other pastors of our church who just loves to cook. And these people pour love into this food.
That's like the final ingredient to like that finishes off all the food, is the love that goes in it.
Exactly. We don't do anything. Even the pies are made fresh from scratch. I mean, we are serious about putting, giving people a home away from home experience.
So with all that attention to detail, I can't imagine cooking for 1,000 people that kind of meal. And what goes into cooking the meal?
I don't know. I don't have to cook. Thank goodness. Oh, you don't want me in the kitchen. Right. Well,
you don't want him in the kitchen.
You don't want me there.
The volunteers help. I mean, that's, whenever you're doing anything of large capacity, you have to break it down, you know, to a simplest form. And it's Pastor Gordon here has done a wonderful job at organizing volunteers that come in to help break down simple things such as peeling potatoes. I mean, 1,000 plates, that's a lot of potatoes, to picking greens, to, to cooking. I mean, the list goes on.
It's an army.
It is an army. And they start from the day before. And all the, or even actually even comes in a couple of days before people actually begin the process as food comes in, to marinating meats, to, I mean, the smoke. I mean, it, the list goes on all the way until, I mean, literally the event is over, because people are still cooking, because sometimes we have so much food that we have to cook it all, even if we don't have all the people there, but we still need to break it down. And so, yeah, that's just a small part.
Did the event start out so large?
No. It's grown over time. To make a long story short, we just have some incredible people. We have to give a lot of thanks to the people of Poshines, and especially Chef James Bradley, because we work with several people. This is a very collaborative event. Hands on Portland is one of our main sources for volunteers. Also, Wells Fargo does a great job of sending volunteers our way. The Kenton Business Association has done an incredible job of gathering businesses from the community in order to help support. It's impossible to do this with a small amount of people. It takes a village, truly. But when it comes to the food, like I said, you don't want me in the kitchen.
No, you don't.
And I have to give a lot of thanks to the people at Poshines, especially James.
Yeah, and then as far as its beginnings, I mean, it's small beginnings. You know, our senior pastor and visionary definitely had an idea of giving back to the community, which was huge. He's a real big community advocate.
And his name is Pastor Albert Mondanay Jr., the founder of Proper.
And, from then on, he would cook himself, and he would help make the meals, and then more and more people started coming. Now we need more plates, and he's like, you know what, I need more help, so I'm gonna go ahead and opt out, you know, as I'm gonna help bring other people in. And it's grown every year. It has grown, and 14 years.
Now, I'm curious who attends the event, because it sounds like it wasn't created for anybody in particular. Who can attend? Who does attend?
Anyone can attend. It's for the entire community. Right. And historically, we've had about 35-40% of people join us who were homeless persons. Another great percentage of people that join us are families with like nowhere to go for a good Thanksgiving meal. And another percentage of people are people who just don't want to be alone for Thanksgiving. So it's open to everybody, but those are the three main people that we've served. And we serve them. Not only is the food made with love and it's incredible, but we also have several volunteer musicians and entertainers from the community come and for the entire time do live music, storytelling, and things of that nature, even dance we've had in the past.
Yeah, I will say, I know there's, when I was growing up, I would help out at, you know, for the Thanksgiving meal at like a soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. And there was just something strange about it. There was kind of like, well, we're here and you're here and we're like doing this for you. But then there wasn't really that like sharing of the meal. So I really love the idea that it's just everybody is coming together and everybody is sitting down and sharing this meal together.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, the people that serve, we are getting to the point right now that we're almost full with volunteers, and every year we get too many volunteers that want to apply. But the people that do get a chance to join us are excited to be there.
It's awesome.
There's no nasty attitudes, just wonderful people who are happy to help. And then our volunteers even partake of the food after they're done serving because it's that good.
Yeah. And it's important. I mean, the people who, there's nothing like preparing food and then being able to actually interact with people who enjoy it. You know, what a conversation to be had. And Poe Shines does, once again, a wonderful job. The food, since it's Southern food or it's a comfort food, it usually brings out great conversations and dialogue. Somebody could take a bite of a sweet potato pie, and who knew that it was similar to what they had as a kid. And now they go back to that place where normally they may not see that place all year, but that one particular moment took them back there. And now you have yourself a dialogue or conversation with this complete stranger that you just met who happened to be experiencing something with the rolls. So it's just amazing to see the interaction from those who prepare the food to those who enjoy the food and even those who clean up afterwards. I mean, everybody is open to good dialogue. The kids, I mean, put food, feed kids, and all of a sudden different conversations come out of their mouths. Like, all of a sudden they're a lot more intellectual than before. Like, I didn't know you knew that. You know, so it's a pretty amazing thing.
Food's something that can connect us all. So are there still spots for volunteers if people are interested in taking part?
There's a few different spots, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. Go to send an email to propervolunteers@gmail.com. That's PROPER volunteers@gmail.com. If you're still interested in volunteering, and we still have a few spots open, but get to it really fast if you want to be a part. You can also, and of course, if you can't be here, but you still want to support, we're still about $1,000 short for the budget. So feel free to give me a call at 503-890-5393 or go to properusa.org, and there's a donate now portion there. So you can support if you so desire. There's also a food needs list and a non-food needs list. If you're not in a position to give food, to give money, but you maybe would like to give food items, give me a call and I'll make certain to get those available to let you know what we still need item-wise.
Great. So we just have one more moment, but I want to make sure that everybody gets the final details, the time, the place, if you want to tell us about the event one more time.
Okay. Again, this is the Proper Kenton Community Thanksgiving Feast, and it's going to be on Thanksgiving Day, November 27th, from noon to 4 p.m. That's Thanksgiving Day, November 27th, from noon to 4 p.m. Over at 8131 North Denver. Once again, that's 8131 North Denver. That's at Celebration Tabernacle Church, right next to Poe Shines Cafe de la Soul. It's on Denver and Kilpatrick. And go to properusa.org for more details and for pictures to give you a feel for what you'd be experiencing if you want to be a part. That's properusa.org.
Great. Thank you so much, Robin and Antoine, for joining us on The Food Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Pastor Robin Gordon, director of Proper, and Pastor Antoine Tolbert, the designer for Proper, a community enhancement organization in North Portland. That's all the time we have for this episode of The Food Show. I want to thank our guests, Robin Gordon, Antoine Tolbert, Michael Mazurek, Katrina Blair, and Marisha Auerbach. I would also like to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy,
Be sure to tune in to the food show again every third Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. Stay with KBOO for an afternoon of jazz coming up next. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel.
I'm Rachel Bennett.
Thanks for listening.
Cause it ain't the right size or perfect. Cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dying.
Okay, that's it for the food show and for public affairs programming this morning at KBOO, KBOO, Portland. Stay tuned. Nick Geffro is in the house to bring you Jazz Lives immediately following the KBOO Noon News.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, November 19th, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, the Portland City Auditor has issued a highly critical review of the city's payment card security standards. According to the report, the city has remained out of compliance with industry data security standards since shortfalls were discovered in 2009. In addition, the City of Portland has not implemented recommendations to secure payment card processing.
In national news, major changes to U.S. immigration policy are expected to be announced by the president during a trip to Del Sol High School in Las Vegas this Friday. The president first announced plans to overhaul the immigration system in 2013 at this same school. Republicans have so far blocked action to change the system. Administration officials said the president has not yet decided on the details of his plan.
The Senate last night voted down a bill that would have increased regulation on domestic spying. The bipartisan bill, led by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, was backed by both progressives and conservatives. It was seeking to end the National Security Agency's once-secret program. The proposed bill was defeated by Senate Republicans when it failed to secure the necessary 60 votes.
The number of homeless children in the U.S. has never been higher, according to a new comprehensive report Monday prepared by the National Center on Family Homelessness. In 2013, approximately 2.5 million children in the United States